and welcome to the Duck Industry Podcast, season number 4. The Duck Industry Podcast is a collaboration with the Programmers of Color Collective and What's Up with Dogs. It is funded by Creative Europe, the City of Leipzig, the BKM and MVM. We thank our partners and supporters for their contributions. Hey, and thank you for listening. Enjoy the show.
Welcome everyone. You are listening to an episode of Dog Industry Podcast dedicated to virtual and augmented reality and the technologies reshaping ways we tell stories. We are about to dive into a fascinating topic, generative AI and its remarkable impact on creativity. My name is Weronika Lewandowska and I am Dog Exchange XR Coordinator, XR Director and Researcher. I am thrilled to host this conversation on how artificial intelligence is reshaping the landscape of filmmaking and expanded reality creation and production. AI is suddenly everywhere, turning heads of many creators, changing the very essence of how we craft narratives and build immersive experiences. It is also a controversial topic that raises many questions about copyrights, ethics, privacy, and the value of human work. What opportunities does it unlock, and what ethical consideration does it raise? How to use it ethically? How can it help filmmakers and creative technologists to think out of the box? AI also examines the limits of our imagination and perception. Today, we will take a look at this broad topic, which is main focus of the Dog Exchange XR program this year. I have the pleasure of introducing our guest, Mads Stamsbo. Mads wears many hats, from being the head of studies at the European Creators Lab to being a visionary creative technologist and experienced designer. Not to mention his directional and production work on projects like Dark Rooms and the upcoming About a Hero, which holds the distinction of being the very first feature film written by AI. Over the past years, Mads has been exploring the fusion of art and AI for artists and filmmakers. In 2020, he founded Casper AI, a platform that collaborates with AI to create art and entertainment, along with providing cutting-edge editing tools for filmmakers. Also, he will be giving a keynote at the upcoming The Dog Exchange XR conference. It's a true privilege to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, we will be focused on AI topic, of course, but I am curious, how did you develop your skills and creativity before getting into AI? Could you share your artistic and technological background and its connection to expanded reality?
Sure. I was always fascinated by technology. I think growing up, the internet came the same time as puberty for me. So I was kind of like growing hand in hand with technology and the utopian idea of what the internet could be and what we could do with it stuck somewhere in my DNA. And so when I went to film school, I was challenging a lot the conventions of how we make films. I was schooled a film producer originally. And I remember very early on, I simply decided I wanted to make a film that couldn't be seen in cinemas in regular ways. It was a live performance mixed with a film, and it was going to be real-time streamed to the cinema's screen. And this experience was so profoundly fun and but also artistically giving, and the audience really had a really big impact on the audience that I didn't expect. And so I think from then on, I knew that I needed to do something that included the audience in the experience in a way that normal film couldn't do. And so from then, I basically discovered virtual reality. I think many people did when the first headsets came out, or there were a lot that did. And for us kind of that were curious about technology, it was a no-brainer that we needed to start making cinematic quality films inside this medium. And so I started developing on several projects, including the Doghouse, which was one of my first VR experiences, a five-person dinner table where the audience would sit and embody one of five characters, either being the mom, the dad, or the new girlfriend, and realizing that their subjective reality was very different from the ones on the other side of the table. And this was all done with sort of gaffer tape cameras put together to create point of view, stereo lenses, and we made our own software to run it on the Oculus DK1, which was the very first headset available. And so, yeah, the rest is kind of history, because otherwise this will be a long answer. But I think that curiosity of what can technology provide in a story and how can it create an impact that is unprecedented, that's something that I've always been married to.
And it's very interdisciplinary approach where the audience is very important. And I think it's very crucial that you started thinking about audience at this moment, because it's something what expanded reality brings to experience inside the headset. It's like it's always dialogue with the person which is inside. And thanks to AI, I think it can be even more open to audience. But how has your artistic background and technological expertise influenced your approach to creativity in the realm of AI? How does what you describe help you with AI and shaping the projects with AI?
Well, actually, it started somewhere else, because when I was introduced to, I mean, I knew about artificial intelligence and was following sort of the technology advancements over the last decade, but I never thought it would come to a stage where I would use it so actively in my productions as I'm doing now. And where it started for me was actually also in a very conceptual way, because the film director that I work with now, Piotr Winevich, he came to me over 3 years ago and said, you know what, I think these machine learning models that are coming, they'll be able to write a film script. And I think they'll be able to write a really good film script. And I think we should make a feature film written by an AI. And that was the concept. And the reason I liked the idea was not necessarily because I believed that AI was capable of writing a better film than humans could write, but because I really wanted to see the result of that experiment. I was personally curious to whether we could get somewhere where we could finance it, we could go into production, we could show it in a cinema, and people would be like, okay, there's an AI film, you know? And so, but then when you start working with it and you see its limitations, but you also see its potential, that's where I started to really understand what AI can do in creative processes, which is, of course, a lot. And we can get into that in more detail if you want. But yeah, so it started in as a more conceptual idea.
But it was 3 years ago. So before ChatGPT has opened our imagination that it's possible. So I guess you use different tools. You had to build your own models.
Well, no, not exactly, because we used GPT-2 before it was 3. But the interesting thing about GPT-2 is that in many ways, what it produced was a little bit more, albeit very abstract and sometimes incoherent. It was very poetic, and it was actually more interesting in some regards than what we see from 3.5 or 4 that we now are using for rewrites of the script. So one of the early things that happened was that after we had trained, so the concept of the film, for those that don't know, is that we were inspired by Werner Herzog's quote from 2016, where he said, a machine will never make a film as good as mine in 4,500 years. And of course, that was a call to action, like a challenge almost, you know, that this was exactly the person we should train an AI to be. Because if we wanted to in any way evaluate whether or not something is as good as or better than someone, then why not the old romantic epic filmmaker Werner Herzog, who everyone, or at least everyone who works with film, has some relation to. And that also has a pretty huge body of work, not only in film, but also in literature. And so he has a lot of written text. And we decided to train our GPT-2 model on, or fine tune it, so to speak, on his material. And after many months of feeding it, which is basically the hardest part of the journey, is to clean the data and make it all readable for the AI. One night in like some cold night, our machine learning engineer, Isburn, decided to test the system for the first time. And in order to test the system, you have to prompt it with something. You have to give it some kind of initial prompt. And he decided to use the word something. And from the word something came a 3-page poem, I would say, or like short essay that started basically like this. It said, "This is a movie about a hero dreaming up surprisingly ordinary dreams." That was the first sentence of this. And it went on to describe a lot of characters. It described a lot of scenarios and things that might happen in this film. And we were really floored because it resembled the way Herzog would talk about a theme. It resembled how he would approach dreams and reality, and his sort of artistic voice was shining through somehow. But also there was a machine underneath that was also shining through. So there was this doubleness in this text. So we decided to call the film About a Hero, based on the first line that the machine produced. And I think that's just some context to how this sort of creative process started. And of course, it didn't write the full script at once. You then have to interrogate the machine. And the early models were all over the place. And they were, you know, not coherent. They didn't have temporal memory. So they couldn't remember what conversation we had just had. And they would go in another direction. Now, of course, these newer models, they have temporal memory. They know what session you're in. And you can sort of refer back to characters that you already created. So our script developed in parallel to how the technology developed. And for every time a new version of the model came out, we were able to do more advanced rewrites and iterations on the script.
It sounds like from the beginning it was a really creative process with artificial intelligence, like challenging your creativeness. And I am wondering how you have found balance with this tool. Like, did it overwhelm you at some point, or how you shape the script with AI? And maybe is there any other layer of the production that you used AI on only for the script?
Oh, there's many layers that we're using AI in. The main sort of idea is the script. And so 95% of the script is written by an AI. We did decide to do some modifications to help the script flow so that, you know, we placed it in the right order. We curated the scenes. It doesn't have an idea of structure. So we helped it to create structure on all the different stories that it was telling. And we also discarded stories that it, you know, we didn't think were interesting. So in a way, we acted as curators of the story. And it became almost like a waterfall where the more you fed, the more you were given back. And then you pooled things that you liked, and then you fed it again with what you liked. And then it kept, you know, pouring into new pools that you could pull from. So it was like this long process of generating material and then pulling it, pooling it, and then choosing it, and then re-prompting it. And regards to your other question about other technologies, what we realized while we were making the film was that maybe we weren't only making a script writer, we were also making a filmmaker, right? We were also trying to make a film where the AI's sort of point of view was visible. So how does it see the film? So we asked, you know, what does this location look like? Or describe this character, or, you know, draw me mood boards of this scene. So all these things are now part of the production package. Everything from character descriptions to location images. And we try to find locations that then look exactly like the locations that it produced, right? And we will even be using generative techniques and deepfake techniques, because you, of course, have to put Herzog in the film, but he isn't physically with us, so we have to deepfake him into the film, etc. So there's several techniques where we're using AI, and also in the film explaining those techniques as we go along, because we want the audience to not only watch this film and see what AI can do, we also want them to understand the underlying processes and considerations and ethical questions that might arise when doing so. So in that way, the film is both a demonstration and a contemplation on AI, but it's also an actual reflection together with real people as a real documentary, not a synthetic one.
Okay, so it's a documentary. It's like you can think about it about like a documentary, and you have Herzog as a narrator or actor of what is his role in this movie?
Well, so I'm not sure I want to go into too many details about the film, just because we haven't shot the whole film yet and we're still in production. But what I can say is that the structure of the film is that there is a synthetic documentary that was written by an AI as if it was a documentary, but with places that don't exist, people that don't exist, and a fictive narrative of what happened that the fake Herzog goes to explore. That's what's happening in the synthetic documentary. And then we have a real documentary that is then following that process as we're doing it. So these are the two things that are weaved together into one film.
Okay, so maybe, I don't know if it will be the last question about this project, but I am wondering how Herzog felt about it. You know, it's because it's also ethical question. Can we use the image of a person and use deepfake for that, and how we will also the question for the future productions when we will use the image of some actors who are dead, for example. So, but here you can have a feedback from the person, and I'm wondering what kind of feedback you got from him.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, Herzog, he knows about the project. He has given his consent for us to make the project, but he's also highly skeptical. And he's not only skeptical, he believes that we will fail and that we will fail miserably to make a film as good as his. And I think that's the position that he shall have or should have, right? It's also we're not claiming that our film will be better than any film that Werner Herzog could do. But we do want the audience to come out of the cinema thinking, well, how close are we actually? What are the actual differences between a story told by a machine and a story told by humans? And does it matter? And I think those questions are important for the future, because we are going to step into an age where machines will be able to mimic and replicate and mirror our collective consciousness, so to speak. And in doing so, I think there will be a lot of content, stories around us that are fabricated, synthesized, And how do we feel about that as a humankind? And it's already happening. I mean, it's happening right now. It's happening. If you go online, you search for Vermeer's woman with pearl earrings, and you find a fake synthesized image of her with light bulbs instead of pearls. And no one is telling you that this is an AI-generated image, but it will, for now, be stuck to the Google search of Vermeer's famous painting. And so the pollution of the stories that we surround us with is happening right now. And so I think we have a grand responsibility as filmmakers and storytellers to explore this topic and to understand all the implications, but also to reflect on how we feel about being surrounded by synthetic storytelling.
Especially when you are producing documentary piece, because it's like testimony of the past or present. We have a lot of fake news today. We need to develop a sense of what is real, what is fake. And I'm wondering how we can trust AI that it will not hallucinate, you know, about past. Do you know any tools which can protect us, which creators can use for during the process to be sure that, or how they can verify information the AI is creating?
I can't give you any practical tools off the top of my head, but what I can say is that I think the deeper question here is, will they ever stop hallucinating? And are we, and are humans also not hallucinating all the time? I mean, if you think about it, the way AI works is that it creates us an image from a diffusion, or at least the way these kind of models that we have now, how they diffuse an image and hallucinate it together, have a high level of accuracy in some regards, but in some other regards, it's completely off, right? And I think in a way, I mean, humans do the same. We don't know what is true. We don't know what is objectively the truth. We can believe that there is an objective truth, and we can try to have sources and institutions and peer reviews and all sorts of things that act as sort of markers of truth. But we will all be, you know, consciously hallucinating all the time. And when we agree on some kind of hallucination together, then we call it reality, right? Like, this is famous neuroscientist Anil Seth talks about, is like, that's just how human cognition works. We're projecting it and assuming that this is how reality is, and then we're changing it as we go along by corrections of what comes in through our outer stimuli. And I think that we're probably closer to machines than we think. And in my personal opinion, and this is not something that, you know, the film necessarily will give an answer on, but my personal opinion is that we are close to being machines, or machines are close to being us in many ways, and that there lies a kind of weird kinship and a common ground in storytelling that we both can enjoy from, and that maybe we should appreciate synthetic storytelling for what it is, and not necessarily be afraid of it hallucinating. But that said, I'm of course all for some sort of stamp of truth, that some things are verified, that some things are, you know, backed up by several sources. And these kind of things, I think, are super important in terms of misinformation and disinformation. But when it comes to storytelling, fiction, I don't know. You know, why not listen to the machine dream?
I think you said something really inspiring about this AI, that it can be like a mirror for us, for humans, that we again ask about what is truth, and if we are always right, because what we think, it's the matter of our perception, which can be really like hallucinating. So I really like this idea of asking important questions again at that time, at that world where we live, because we very easily forget about important issues.
I think it's also one of those things where in the past we've talked about collective consciousness as something that was represented somewhere on the internet, or that it was there, you know, but being able to actually access it and interrogate it and pull information from it, that has been an impossibility. That, you know, that would require us to, as one human, to scope everything that's happening online at once, which would be impossible for any one person. And so and so in a way, what these models are also giving us an access to is like this unprecedented force of information and of knowledge and of creativity that is humankind up until now, and that represents us in many ways, including all the biases, of course, and all the shit that also is in there. But has both the good and the bad, has all the things that are human. And I think it's very inspiring to have that access right now and be able to, in a creative way, use it as a tool to understand what stories to tell next, right? So in a way, it's lifting us as storytellers to another level of how we might be able to tell stories. So I think that's very inspiring. And I think that's also how I see the future of using AI, is that I'm not afraid that it will take over our storytelling per se, and we will be, you know, flooded with stories that are not our own. I see more a tendency towards creators and artists and filmmakers using these models, training them on something specific, using data as the foundation for the way that they want this tool to work for them, being aware of how it's trained and what it's trained on, and then using it creatively and actively in their process to create something that hasn't been done before. You know, and this is kind of like this advanced tool concept that you know, you can have a Stradivarius, right? But it's the most complex, beautiful instrument in the world. But if you don't know how to use it and you don't have training on how to use it, it'll sound like shit. But if you're really good at playing the violin, then this is going to be the most beautiful sound in the world.
Yeah, and of course, when you develop this relationship with some technology, some tool, it also can change and influence your perception. So I think that this AI technology will shape our perception, will change our attitude to the world and creation, of course. I would like to come back to this question, this quote, which inspired you to create your movie with AI. A computer will not create a film as good as mine in 4,500 years. That's the quote, words of Werner Herzog. And it provokes me to ask you a question about generations. You know, if it's the characteristic only for older generation of artists to ask, like, don't believe that AI can be helpful, can change something, open them. Because you are the mentor for the European Creators Lab, and you are meeting young people, so is it a half generation difference how young people, how participants of the European Creators Lab think about AI? Are they afraid about using this or open? Could you tell some insight? Do you have any insight on this topic from your experience?
That's a good question. I haven't considered it actually over the difference in generations. And funnily enough, I think, you know, even though Herzog said this, I just saw recently that He was developing poetry together with AI. That was just released in New York Times article, I think a couple of days ago. And, you know, so he's skeptical, but he's also curious. And I think it has less to do with generations, because it has more to do with people that are, you know, explorative and adventurous and courageous about things that are new. And there's, you know, there will always be these like first movers that think that these kind of technologies are inspiring and point to a different future and can assist and help them in different ways. But obviously, being in a younger generation, I mean, growing up with a smartphone that talks to you, it's going to be easier to sort of just get started and jump right into it. I think we all have like a comprehensive, or like what can you call it? Like we all have this issue of understanding what's happening in the black box, which I think is common for anyone that is interested in working with it, that it's still kind of, and even for the scientists that make these models, they can't really explain why they're doing what they're doing. And so I think this black box is something we need to better describe and to better understand for it to be sort of a tool that will be more universal for everyone to use. Because I see a lot of people just jumping into it and then either being discouraged by it or being frightened by it, or because they don't really know which tool they've been using, why and how, and what's it been trained on, and how to ask it questions. You know, there's still a lot of like illiteracy in working with machine learning. And so, but that's a question of just having better education and podcasts like this and workshops, etc.
Yeah, I also think young people, they really want to create content for like social media. That's the way how they express themselves, communicate with other people. So AI could be helpful in user-generated content. Also for XR, I guess it's very useful for prototyping or creating. And I would like to ask you how Casper AI works.
Sure. Well, that's so that's a little bit of a different place in the value chain. We work in the film is all about what is needed to create the story that we want to then film and then edit and make into a film. Whereas Casper AI is more focused on the post-production aspect. So the tools that we're building and the specific tool that we're actually just about to release for alpha users is an editing tool that sits right inside your Premiere Pro software. So you're in the middle of your editing software. And what Casper does is that it analyzes your footage, no matter how much you have. It both visually analyzes and auditively analyzes. So it listens to what's being said. And once it's done that, you can then, with a text prompt, search for anything in your material in any way you want. So let's say you were looking for your main character smiling. You know, then you write the name of your character smiming, and that those images will appear. But you can also search for anything that's been said. You can even search for things that they are talking about without them using that specific word. So I'm interested in places where people talk about philosophy of filmmaking, and it will find those conversations in your material. So it's this very smart assistant that editors can use to generate results really quickly. And the way the results are generated is that they actually pop into a timeline so that your search results are already assembled into a sequence. And you can then either decide to keep that sequence, choose parts of it, or discard it and search for more. But it's all text input and kind of like how you would prompt GPT-3. You prompt Casper and then you get your results.
who can use this software, this plugin, I don't know how you call it.
Plugin extension, it's a sort of tool that you can use inside Premiere. Well, in theory, anyone that wants to try it can be a member of our Discord channel, and we will release it within the next 2 weeks or so for an alpha group. All you need is basically to have a good computer setup with Premiere Pro running, and then you can install it and start testing it. But of course, we're the target group for this is professional editors or editing assistants that are working either professionally in companies and studios, but also people working with their own content, prosumers. So there are around 10 million Premiere users in the world that I think could benefit from this.
There are AI tools created to protect us from AI manipulation, like PhotoGuard, developed by MIT researchers, which modify images in a manner indiscernible to humans, while preventing AI system from making adjustments to them. If someone tries to use an editing app based on generative AI model, such as Stable Diffusion, to manipulate the image that has been immunized by PhotoGuard, the outcome will appear unnatural. How can we shape our relationship with AI regarding copyrights? What do you think about it? Do we need this protection, like AI tools against AI, to like give the credits for people, or, you know, because it's really important issue, copyrights. Like, we have this guilds of scriptwriters around the world who are engaging in protest and so on. So there is this question rising. And I don't know what's the right solution for that, because of course you can learn, you are inspired. Even when you create, you are inspired by some people. So you always digest some information.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really hard question, because it really comes down to the specific use cases, you know, like where is it used and how much is it used and is it taking, you know, a substantial part of the creative process away from humans, and therefore should be somehow claimed or labeled as such? I think, you know, for instance, with our tool, with the Caspar tool, you won't be able to know that an AI assisted you in editing, right? Because it's just for now, just a search tool. But, and it's working within your workflow, and it's, you know, anything you spit out of Premiere will just be a film sequence like any other. So you won't be able to detect that an AI was assisting you in this. You won't be able to detect that an AI wrote the script for something and then someone shot it. So, you know, the question of, you know, I think it's a utopian idea that we can label everything correctly out of, like, you know, some kind of smart AIs that can look at stuff. I think that's going to be impossible. It's going to infiltrate the processes, creative processes all around the world in all sorts of industries. And so I don't think we're able to do that. But what probably should be done, and which I think is what's happening with the guild strike, is that when you see these changes happening where producers are saying, well, why not just make an AI write the first draft and then let, you know, humans write the second draft? There is where there should be a strike, which there is, and there should be, you know, an uproar to say, well, maybe that's not the future we want, where stories are originating from machines and then should be retold or refurbished by humans. So those kind of battles should be done in each an individual industry. And yeah, I think that's going to be an ongoing discussion for the next many years, is going to be how do we place the copyright on this? And even, you know, there is a world where it might be okay that there is, copyright given to a company that just deployed a machine to do something, right? And that they then own the copyright. I think there is a world where that's possible. The question is always, you know, what is it trained on? Again, are you using OpenAI's model where they have all these artists that they just, you know, without consent, took their data? And I guess it's going to be up to the individual industries and to the individual governmental regulations on like how we want to regulate this. I personally really don't think that we should be that preoccupied about, you know, whether your work has been part of training a model. I think humans should look forward instead of backwards and see it more as like a being part of a collected record of human creativity is like your contribution to something that then will spring new ideas and new originality from. So for me, it's a little backwards thinking to be so preoccupied about, well, you know, is the machine inspired by my work? Yes, it is. But a million people could be inspired by your work and draw something similar, but they, you know, you wouldn't be replicating your work, right? Obviously, if someone uses Midjourney to then recreate a Picasso painting and then call it a Picasso painting, and it's obviously a fake, you know, then we have like real copyright issues. But are we inspired by Picasso and made an AI picture? Is that a problem? I don't really see the problem, right? I mean, and I think an art dealer would also be like, who gives a shit that you made an AI version of a Picasso? I want the real Picasso, right? So that's just my personal opinion, but it will be a discussion we'll have for many years.
So we inspire AI and AI inspires us. So it's yes. both way exchange somehow. Of course, if we are open to use this new tool and experiment with it. Regarding experimenting, I would like to ask you about your plans for a prototyping lab in Leipzig, because we are meeting in October for Doc Exchange XR, and you are leading workshops and creation of prototypes during the European Creators Lab. Could you provide some insight into the mentors you have in mind or you have invited, and who will be present in Leipzig during that time? And of course, are you planning to use AI?
Yes, so the prototype lab in Leipzig, which I think maybe there's still an open call for, if you are out there and you have a project, you should apply. It's one of my favorite labs of the European Creators Lab series, because there are three labs every year that we plan and that we execute. And this one is the one dedicated to actually making a part of a project to validate whether it works or not, and what it gives us as an audience and what it tells us as creators on how to proceed with the project. So I've always been a huge fan of that process, because the prototyping is really where you learn the most and have something to show for it. And if you dare to fail, you can learn a lot from it. And so it's one of my favorite times. And usually what we did last year is that we had a lot of very technically creative and talented people that can actually jump into code or jump into the creation of a prototype. So it was a group of people that I've worked with over the years, or that I know have the talents to do that I collected for the prototyping lab. And it'll be similar this year. We'll have many of the same creative technologists there that can really get down and dirty and hands-on with the projects that come in. And what's cool about it this year, I think, is that we're planning to somehow showcase this in synergy with the Leipzig Exchange and like with the whole industry. And I think what's the most scary, but also the most productive, is to have an audience at the end of your prototyping, even if it can fail, even if things won't go right. You'll just push yourself a little harder, and you'll also have some actual feedback from industry and from audiences that can be very valuable for your further progression. So for me, I'm looking forward to that a lot.
Yeah, we are also looking forward to you and all of you listening us today. And I hope you will join us. It was our amazing guest, Mads Damsbo. Thank you for joining us today. We are truly grateful for your insight and perspective on AI and immersive storytelling. We can't wait to meet you in Leipzig for the Exchange XR and the European Creators Lab Collaboration and Networking Week. Thank you, Mads.
Thank you.
I would like to thank Anneliese Redford, René Blumel and Timon Misselhorn for their hard work behind the scene in bringing this episode to life. Thank you for listening. Check out the Doc Exchange XR program on our website. And for more inspiration, see you in October in Leipzig.